It is, I suppose, the romantic streak that has made and no doubt will make empires. Warning that it was bound to come out that a modern Columbus was turned down in England, he offered the society one last chance to support the mission. The RGS bred me as an explorer, and I don't want them to be out of an expedition that was sure to make history, he said. Finally, with Kelty and other supporters lobbying on his behalf, and with scientists around the world gravitating toward the possibility of Z, the society voted to support the expedition and help furnish it with equipment. The total raised amounted to roughly $5,000, less than the cost of one of Dr. Rice's radios. This was not enough money for Fawcett, Jack, or Raleigh to draw a salary, and much of the financing from newspapers would be paid only upon completion of their journey. If they don't return, there will be nothing for the family to live on, Nina later wrote to Large. Not a sum which would inspire most explorers, Fawcett told Kelty. But he added in another letter, In some ways, I am rather glad that not one of the three of us makes a red cent unless the journey is successful, for nobody can say we were after money in undertaking this rather perilous quest. It is an honest scientific research animated by its own exceptional interest and value. Fawcett and Jack paid a visit to the RGS, where all the ill feelings, all the frustrations, seemed to have evaporated. Everyone wished them luck. Reeves, the Society's map curator, later recalled what a fine young fellow Jack was, well-built, tall and strong, very like his father. Fawcett expressed his gratitude to Reeves and Kelty, who had never wavered in their support. I shall rejoice in telling you the whole story in 3 years' time, he said. Back at Stoke Cannon, Fawcett, Jack, and the rest of the family were thrown into a whirl of packing and planning. It was decided that Nina and Joan, who was 14, would move to the Portuguese island of Madeira, where it was cheaper to live. Brian, who was devastated that his father had not chosen him for the expedition, had turned his attention to railroad engineering. With Fawcett's help, he found work with a railroad company in Peru and was the first to depart for South America. The family accompanied Brian, who was only 17 at the time, to the train station. Fawcett told Brian that he would be responsible for Nina and his sister's care during the expedition, and that any financial assistance he could give them would help them survive. The family made plans for the return of Fawcett and Jack as heroes. In 2 years' time, they would be back, and when my first home leave fell due, we would all meet again in England, Brian later recalled. After that, we might make a family home in Brazil, where the work of the future years would undoubtedly lie. Brian said farewell to his family and stepped onto the train. As the carriage pulled away, he stared out the window, watching as his father and brother slowly disappeared from view. On December 3, 1924, Fawcett and Jack said goodbye to Joan and Nina and boarded the Aquitania for New York, where they were to meet Raleigh. The path to Z finally seemed secure. When they landed in New York a week later, however, Fawcett discovered that Lynch, his business partner of unimpeachable character, had sequestered himself, drunk and surrounded by prostitutes, in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. He succumbed to the lure of the ubiquitous bottle in this prohibition city, Fawcett wrote the RGS. He said that Lynch must have suffered from alcoholic aberration. It may be more, for he was sexually disturbed. The aberration had cost more than $1,000 of the expedition's funds, and Fawcett feared that the mission was in danger of unraveling before it began. Yet the venture had already become an international sensation, prompting John D. Rockefeller Jr., the scion of the billionaire founder of Standard Oil and an ally of Dr. Bowman, to step forward with a check for $4,500 so that the plan can be initiated at once. With his path to Z again clear, Fawcett could no longer even work up his notorious wrath toward Lynch, who had returned to London in disgrace. He did precipitate this exploration, which is something to his credit, and the gods select curious agents for their purposes sometimes, Fawcett wrote the RGS. Plus, he said, I am a great believer in the law of compensation. he was sure that he had sacrificed all he had to give to reach Z. Now he hoped to receive what he called the honor of immortality. Chapter 19. An Unexpected Clue.
Yeah, I've heard of Fawcett, a Brazilian guide who offered tours of the Amazon told me. Isn't he the one who disappeared looking for El Dorado or something?
When I mentioned that I was seeking a guide to help me trace Fawcett's route and look for Z, he replied that he was muito ocupado, which seemed to be a polite way of saying, you're out of your mind. It was difficult to find someone not only willing to make the journey into the jungle, but also with ties to the indigenous communities in Brazil, which function almost as autonomous countries, with their own laws and governing councils. The history of the interaction between broncos and indios, whites and Indians, in the Amazon, often reads like an extended epitaph. Tribes were wiped out by disease and massacres. Languages and songs were obliterated. One tribe buried its children alive to spare them the shame of subjugation. But some tribes, including the dozens that remain uncontacted, have managed to insulate themselves in the jungle. In recent decades, as many indigenous peoples have organized themselves politically, the Brazilian government has stopped trying to modernize them and has worked more effectively to protect them. As a result, some Amazon tribes, particularly those in the Mato Grosso region, where Fawcett disappeared, have flourished. Their populations, after being decimated, are growing again. Their languages and customs have endured. The person I eventually persuaded to accompany me was Paulo Pinage, a 52-year-old former professional samba dancer and theater director. Though Paulo was not of Indian descent, he had previously worked for FUNAI, the agency that succeeded Rondon's Indian Protection Service. Paulo shared its "die if you must, but never kill" edict. During our initial phone conversation, I had asked him if we could penetrate the same region that Fawcett had, including part of what is now the Xingu National Park, Brazil's first Indian reservation, which was created in 1961. The park, along with an adjoining reservation, is the size of Belgium and is one of the largest swaths of jungle under Indian control in the world. Paulo said, "I can take you there, but it's not easy." Entering Indian territories, he explained, required elaborate negotiations with tribal leaders. He asked me to send him medical records attesting that I carried no contagious diseases. Then he began approaching various chiefs on my behalf. Many of the tribes in the jungle now had shortwave radios, a more modern version of what Dr. Rice had used. And for weeks, our messages were relayed back and forth as Paulo assured them that I was a reporter and not a garimpero, or prospector. In 2004, 29 diamond miners trespassed onto a reservation in western Brazil, and members of the Cinta Larga tribe shot them or beat them to death with wooden clubs. Paulo told me to meet him at the airport in Cuiabá. Although none of the tribes had agreed to my visit, he seemed optimistic when he greeted me. He was carrying several large plastic containers instead of a suitcase or a backpack, and had a cigarette dangling from his lip. He wore a camouflage vest with myriad pockets, stuffed with supplies, a Swiss army knife, a Japanese anti-itch medicine, a flashlight, a bag of peanuts, and more cigarettes. He resembled someone returning from an expedition, not embarking on one. His vest was ragged, his face was bone thin and covered with a gray-tinged beard, and his bald head had been seared by the sun. His English pronunciation was shaky, yet he spoke as fast as he smoked.
"Come, come, we go now," he said. "Paulo, take care of everything."
We took a taxi to the center of Cuiabá, which was no longer the ghost town Fawcett had described, but had an air of modernity, with paved roads and a few modest skyscrapers. Brazilian settlers had once been lured into the interior by rubber and gold. Now the primary temptation was the high price of commodities from ranching and farming, and the city served as a staging ground for these latest pioneers. We checked into a hotel named El Dorado.
A funny coincidence, isn't it? Paolo said, and began making preparations. Our first challenge was to ensure that we correctly divined Fawcett's route. I filled Paolo in about my trip to England and about everything Fawcett had done, including planting false leads and using ciphers to conceal his course. This colonel goes to many lengths to hide something that no one has ever found, Paolo said. I spread the relevant documents that I had obtained in British archives on a wooden table. Among them were copies of several of Fawcett's original maps. They were meticulous, recalling pointillist paintings. Paolo picked one up and examined it for several minutes under the light. Fawcett had printed "Unexplored" in bold letters atop one image, which depicted the forests between the Xingu River and two other major tributaries of the Amazon. On another map, he added several notations, small tribes, believed to be friendly, very bad Indian tribes, names unknown, Indians probably dangerous. One of the maps seemed somewhat crudely drawn, and Paolo asked if Fawcett had made it. I explained that a notation on the map, which I had found among several old documents from the North American Newspaper Alliance, indicated that it had belonged to Raleigh Rimmel. He had sketched on the map the expedition's route and given it to his mother. Although he made her promise to destroy it after he left, she had held on to it. Paolo and I agreed that the documents confirmed that Fawcett and his team, after leaving Cuyaba, had proceeded north to the territory of the Bacairi Indians. From there, they had gone to Dead Horse Camp, and then, presumably, deep into what is today Xingu National Park. In the route that Fawcett had supplied in confidence to the Royal Geographical Society, he wrote that his party would turn due east around the 11th parallel south of the equator and continue past the River of Death and the Araguaia River until they reached the Atlantic Ocean. Fawcett noted in his proposal that it was preferable to maintain an eastward trajectory toward Brazil's coastal regions, since it would preserve a higher level of enthusiasm than one proceeding farther and farther into the wilds. Yet one segment of the route Raleigh had drawn seemed to contradict this. At the Araguaia River, Raleigh indicated the expedition would turn sharply northward instead of continuing eastward and would pass from Mato Grosso into the Brazilian state of Pará before exiting near the mouth of the Amazon River. Maybe Raleigh made a mistake, Paolo said. That's what I thought too, I said. But then I read this. I showed him the last letter that Jack had sent his mother. Paolo read the line I had highlighted. Next time I write will probably be from Pará. I think Fawcett kept this last piece of his route secret even from the RGS, I said. Paolo seemed increasingly intrigued by Fawcett, and with a black pen he began to trace Fawcett's route on a clean map, excitedly ticking off each of our intended destinations. Finally, he took his cigarette out of his mouth and said, "On to Z, no?" Chapter 20. Have No Fear. The train creaked toward the frontier. On February 11, 1925, Fawcett, Jack, and Raleigh had left Rio de Janeiro on their more than 1,000-mile journey into the interior of Brazil. In Rio, they had stayed in the Hotel Internacional, where they tested their equipment in the garden and where virtually everything they did was chronicled in newspapers around the world. At least 40 million people are already aware of our objective, Fawcett wrote his son Brian, reveling in the tremendous publicity. There were photographs of the explorers with headlines like, "Three men face cannibals in relic quest." One article said, "No Olympic Games contender was ever trained down to a finer edge than these three reserved, matter-of-fact Englishmen, whose pathway to a forgotten world is beset by arrows, pestilence, and wild beasts." "Aren't the reports of the expedition in the English and American papers amusing?" Jack wrote his brother. Brazilian authorities, fearing the demise of such an illustrious party on their territory, demanded that Fawcett sign a statement absolving them of responsibility, which he did without hesitation. "They do not want to be pressed if we do not turn up," Fawcett told Kelty. "But we shall all turn up, all right, even if it is just about as much as my 58 years can put up with. Despite such concerns, the government and its citizens warmly received the explorers. The party would be given free transport to the frontier on railroad cars reserved for dignitaries, luxurious carriages with private baths and saloons. "We have met with unbounded sympathy and goodwill," Fawcett informed the RGS. Raleigh seemed somewhat dispirited, though. On the voyage from New York, he had fallen in love, apparently with the daughter of a British duke. "I became acquainted with a certain girl on board, and as time went on, our friendship increased till I admit it was threatening to get serious," he confessed in a letter to Brian Fawcett. He wanted to tell Jack about his turbulent emotions, but his best friend, who had become even more priestly while training for the expedition, complained that he was making a fool of himself. Whereas before Raleigh had been intently focused on his adventure with Jack, now all he could think about was this woman. "The Colonel and Jack were getting quite anxious, afraid I should elope or something," Raleigh wrote. Indeed, Raleigh contemplated getting married in Rio, but Fawcett and Jack dissuaded him. "I came to my senses and realized I was supposed to be the member of an expedition and not allowed to take a wife along," Raleigh said. "I had to drop her gently and attend to business." "Raleigh is much better now," Jack wrote. Still, he worriedly asked Raleigh, "I suppose after we get back, you'll be married within a year?" Raleigh replied that he wouldn't make any promises, but, as he later put it, "I don't intend to be a bachelor all my life, even if Jack does." The three explorers stopped for a few days in Sao Paulo and went to visit the Instituto Butantan, one of the largest snake farms in the world. The staff carried out a series of demonstrations for the explorers, showing how various predators strike. At one point, an attendant reached into a cage with a long hook and removed a lethal bushmaster, while Jack and Raleigh stared at its fangs. "A whole lot of venom squirted out," Jack later wrote his brother. Fawcett was familiar with Amazonian snakes, but he still found the demonstrations enlightening, and he shared his notes in one of his dispatches for the North American Newspaper Alliance. "A snake bite which bleeds is non-poisonous. Two punctures, plus a bluish and bloodless patch, is a sign of poison." Before leaving, Fawcett was handed what he most wanted, 5 years' worth of anti-snake bite serums stored in vials marked rattlesnakes, pit vipers, and unknown species. He also received a hypodermic needle to inject them. After local officials in Sao Paulo gave the explorers what Jack described as a fine send-off, the three Englishmen again boarded a train heading west toward the Paraguay River, along the border of Brazil and Bolivia. Fawcett had made the same trip in 1920 with Holt and Brown, and the familiar vista only intensified his chronic impatience. As sparks flew up from the rails, Jack and Raleigh looked out the window, watching the swamps and scrub forest pass, imagining what they would soon encounter. "I saw some quite interesting things," Jack wrote. "In the cattle country were numerous parrots, and we saw two flocks of young rheas, ostrich-like birds, about 4 to 5 feet high. There was a glimpse of a spider's web in a tree, with a spider about the size of a sparrow sitting in the middle. Spotting alligators on the banks, he and Raleigh grabbed their rifles and tried to shoot them from the moving train." The immensity of the landscape awed Jack, who occasionally sketched what he saw as if to help him comprehend it, a habit ingrained in him by his father. In a week, the men reached Corumbá, a frontier town near the Bolivian border, not far from where Fawcett had carried out much of his early exploration. This marked the end of the railroad line and the explorers' lavish accommodations, and that night they stayed in a squalid hotel. "The lavatory arrangements here are very primitive," Jack wrote his mother. "The combined bathroom and shower room is so filthy that one must be careful where one treads. But Daddy says we must expect much worse in Cuiabá." Jack and Raleigh heard a commotion outside the hotel and saw, in the moonlight, figures parading up and down the city's only good road, singing and dancing. It was the last night of Carnival. Raleigh, who liked to stay out late drinking several excellent cocktails, joined in the revelry. "I am now, by the way, quite an enthusiastic dancer," he had earlier informed his brother. You will probably think me reckless, eh? But still, I figured I would have very few chances to dissipate in the next 20 months or so. On February 23, Fawcett told Jack and Raleigh to load their equipment onto the Igatemi, a small, dirty ship docked along the Paraguay River, which was bound for Cuiabá. Raleigh dubbed the ship the Little Tub. It was supposed to hold 20 passengers, but more than twice that many crammed inside. The air reeked of sweat and burning wood from the boiler. There were no private quarters, and to hang their hammocks, the men had to jostle for space on the deck. As the boat shoved off, winding northward, Jack practiced his Portuguese with the other passengers. But Raleigh lacked the ear and the patience to pick up more than faz favor, please, and obrigado, thank you. Raleigh is a funny chap, Jack wrote. He calls Portuguese this damn jabbering language and makes no attempt to learn it. Instead, he gets mad at everyone because they don't speak English. In the evenings, the temperature dropped sharply, and the explorers slept in extra shirts, trousers, and socks. They decided not to shave, and their faces were soon covered with stubble. Jack thought Raleigh looked like a desperate villain, such as you see in Western thrillers on the movies. As the boat turned onto the São Lourenço River, and then onto the Cuiabá River, the young men were introduced to the spectrum of Amazonian insects. On Wednesday night, they came aboard in clouds, Jack wrote. The roof of the place where we eat and sleep was black, literally black with them. We had to sleep with shirts drawn over our heads, leaving no breathing hole, our feet wrapped in another shirt, and a Macintosh over the body. Termite ants were another pest. They invaded us for about a couple of hours, fluttering round the lamps till their wings dropped off, and then wriggling over floor and table in their millions. Raleigh insisted that the mosquitoes were almost big enough to hold you down. The Igatemi crept along the river, moving so slowly that once even a canoe shot past it. The boys wanted to exercise, but there was no room on board, and all they could do was stare at the unending swamps. Cuiabá will seem like heaven after this, Jack wrote his mother. 2 days later, he added, Daddy says this is the dullest, most boring river journey he has ever made. On March 3, 8 days after leaving Curumbá, the Igatemi drifted into Cuiabá, which Raleigh called a godforsaken hole, best seen with the eyes closed. Fawcett wrote that they had reached the stepping-off point into the jungle and were waiting several weeks for the rainy season to let up for the attainment of the great purpose. Although Fawcett hated to linger, he didn't dare leave before the dry season had arrived, as he had done disastrously in 1920 with Holt. And there were still things to do, provisions to be collected and maps to be pored over. Jack and Raleigh tried to break in their new boots by trekking through the surrounding bush. Raleigh's feet are covered with patches of Johnson's plaster, but he is keener than ever now that we are nearing the day of departure, Jack said. They carried their rifles and set up target practice, shooting at objects as if they were jaguars or monkeys. Fawcett had warned them to conserve ammunition, yet they were so excited that they spent 20 cartridges on their first attempt. "What a hell of a row!" Jack exclaimed of the noise. Raleigh boasted that he was a fine shot, even if I do say so myself. During meals, the young men consumed additional portions. Jack even broke his vegetarian edict, eating chicken and beef. "We are feeding up now," he told his mother, "and I hope to put on 10 pounds before leaving, as we need extra flesh to carry us over hungry periods during the expedition." An American missionary who was staying in Cuiabá had several issues of Cosmopolitan, the popular monthly magazine owned by William Randolph Hearst. Raleigh and Jack swapped some of their books for them, which evoked a world the young men knew they would not see for at least 2 years. Issues from that period had advertisements for 12-cent cans of Campbell's tomato soup and for the American Telephone and Telegraph Company. Instead of speech through a partition, there is speech across a continent. And such reminders of home seemed to make Raleigh sentimental, as he put it. The magazines also contained several gripping adventure tales, including The Thrill of Facing Eternity, in which the narrator asked, "What do I know about fear? What do I know about courage?" Until actually faced with a crisis, no man knows how he will behave. Rather than confronting their own reservoirs of courage, Jack and Raleigh seemed to prefer to dwell on what they would do after they returned from the expedition. They were sure that the journey would make them rich and famous, but their fantasies remained more those of boys than of men. "We intend to buy motorcycles and really enjoy a good holiday in Devon, looking up all our friends and visiting the old haunts," Jack said. One morning, they went with Fawcett to purchase pack animals from a local rancher. Though Fawcett complained that he was cheated over everything, he acquired 4 horses and 8 donkeys. "The horses being fairly good, but the mules very fraco, weak," Jack said in a letter home, showing off his newest Portuguese word. Jack and Raleigh immediately gave the animals names. An obstinate mule was Gertrude. Another, with a bullet-shaped head, was Dum-Dum. And a third, forlorn-looking animal, was Sorehead. Fawcett also obtained a pair of hunting dogs that were, as he put it, rejoicing in the names of Pastor and Chulim. By then, nearly everyone in the remote capital had heard of the famous Englishman. Some inhabitants regaled Fawcett with legends of hidden cities. One man said that he had recently brought an Indian from the jungle who, upon seeing the churches in Cuiabá, remarked, "This is nothing. In my forest are buildings bigger and loftier by far than this. They have doors and windows of stone. The inside is lit by a great square crystal on a pillar. It shines so brightly as to dazzle the eyes." Fawcett was grateful for any visions, however preposterous, that might confirm his own. "I have seen no reason to budge a hair's breadth from the theory of Z," he wrote Nina. Around this time, Fawcett heard the first news of Dr. Rice's expedition. For several weeks, there had been no reports of the party, which had been exploring a tributary of the Rio Branco, about 1,200 miles north of Cuiabá. Many feared that the men had vanished. Then an amateur radio operator in Caterham, England, picked up on his wireless receiver Morse signals coming from deep in the Amazon. The operator jotted down the message: "Progress slow, owing to extremely difficult physical conditions. Personnel expedition numbers over 50. Unable to use hydroplane at present due low water. Objects expedition being attained. All well. This message sent by expedition's own wireless. Rice." Another message reported that Dr. Theodore Koch Grunberg, the noted anthropologist with the party, had contracted malarial fever and had died. Dr. Rice announced on the wireless that he was about to deploy the hydroplane, although it had to be swept clean of ants and termites and spiderwebs, which covered the control panel and cockpit like volcanic ash. The men worried what would happen if they had to land in an emergency. Albert William Stevens, a noted balloonist and the expedition's aerial photographer, told the RGS, "If not over a waterway, parachuting would be advisable before the plane crashed in the massive trees of the forest. The only hope of the flyers would then be to find the wreck of their craft and secure food. With machete and compass, they could perhaps cut their way to the nearest river, build a raft, and escape. A broken arm or leg would mean certain death, of course." Finally, the men filled the tank with fuel, enough for about 4 hours, and 3 members of the expedition boarded the plane. The pilot started the propeller, and the machine roared down the river, hurtling into the sky. Stevens described the explorer's first vision of the jungle from 5,000 feet up. "The palms below, scattered through the forest, looked like hundreds of starfish at the bottom of an ocean. Except for the spirals, blankets, and clouds of mist-like emanations ascending from numerous hidden streams of water, there was nothing in sight but the somber, seemingly endless forest, premonitory in its silence and vastness." Usually, the pilot and one other member of the party would fly for about 3 hours each morning before the rising temperature outside might cause the engine to overheat. Over several weeks, Dr. Rice and his team surveyed thousands of square miles of the Amazon, an amount inconceivable on foot or even by boat. The men discovered, among other things, that the Parima and the Orinoco rivers did not, as had been suspected, share the same source. Once, the pilot thought he saw something moving between the trees and dived toward the canopy. There was a cluster of white Yanomami Indians. When the plane landed, Dr. Rice tried to establish contact, offering the Indians beads and handkerchiefs. Unlike on his previous expedition, the tribesmen accepted his overtures. After spending several hours with the tribe, Dr. Rice and his party began leaving the jungle. The RGS asked the Caterham operator to convey the congratulations and good wishes of the society. The expedition, despite the unfortunate death of Koch Grünberg, was a historic achievement. In addition to the cartographic discoveries, it had shifted the human vantage point in the Amazon from below the canopy to above, tilting the balance of power that had always favored the jungle over its trespassers. Those regions where the natives are so hostile or the physical obstacles so great as to effectually bar entering on foot, Dr. Rice declared, the airplane passes over easily and quickly. Moreover, the wireless radio had allowed him to keep in contact with the outside world. The Brazilian jungle has ceased to be lonely, the New York Times proclaimed. The RGS hailed in a bulletin the first ever communication by radio to the Society from an expedition in the field. At the same time, the Society recognized, wistfully, that a Rubicon had been crossed. Whether it is an advantage to take off the glamour of an expedition into the unknown by reporting daily is a matter on which opinions will differ. Owing to the huge cost of the equipment, the bulkiness of the radios, and the lack of safe landing places in most regions of the Amazon, Dr. Rice's methods would not be widely adopted for at least another decade. But he had shown the way. To Fawcett, though, there was only one piece of news that mattered. His rival had not found Z. Bounding out of the hotel one April morning, Fawcett felt the blazing sun on his face. The dry season had arrived. After nightfall on April 19, he led Raleigh and Jack through the city, where outlaws carrying Winchester 44 rifles often lingered in the doorways of dimly lit cantinas. Bandits had earlier attacked a group of diamond prospectors staying in the same hotel as Fawcett and his party. A prospector and one of the bandits were killed, and two others seriously wounded, Jack told his mother. The police went to work on the case after a few days, and over a cup of coffee, asked the murderers why they did it. Nothing more has happened. The explorers stopped at the house of John Ahrens, a German diplomat in the region whom they had befriended. Ahrens offered his guest tea and biscuits. Fawcett asked the diplomat if he would relay to Nina and the rest of the world any letters or other news from the expedition that emerged from the jungle. Ahrens indicated that he was pleased to do so, and he later wrote Nina to say that her husband's conversations about Z were so rare and interesting that he had never been happier. The next morning, under Fawcett's watchful eye, Jack and Raleigh put on their explorer outfits, including lightweight, tear-proof pants and Stetsons. They loaded their .30-caliber rifles and armed themselves with 18-inch machetes, which Fawcett had had designed by the best steelmaker in England. A report sent out by Nana was headlined, Unique Outfit for Explorer, Product of Years' Experience in Jungle Research, Weight of Utensils Reduced to Last Ounce. Fawcett hired two native porters and guides to accompany the expedition until the more dangerous terrain, about 100 miles north. On April 20, a crowd gathered to see the party off. At the crack of whips, the caravan jolted forward, Jack and Raleigh as proud as could be. Ahrens accompanied the explorers for about an hour on his own horse. Then, as he told Nina, he watched them march northward into a world so far completely uncivilized and unknown by people. The expedition crossed the Cerrado, or dry forest, which was the least difficult part of the journey. The terrain consisted mostly of short, twisting trees and savanna-like grass, where a few ranchers and prospectors had established settlements. Yet, as Fawcett told his wife in a letter, it was an excellent initiation for Jack and Raleigh, who picked their way slowly, unaccustomed to the rocky ground and the heat. It was so hot, Fawcett wrote in a particularly fervid dispatch, that in the Cuiabá River, fish were literally cooked alive. By twilight, they had trekked 7 miles, and Fawcett signaled to set up camp. Jack and Raleigh learned that this meant a race, before darkness enveloped them and the mosquitoes devoured their flesh, to string their hammocks, clean their cuts to prevent infections, collect firewood, and secure the pack animals. Dinner was sardines, rice, and biscuits. A feast compared with what they would eat once they had to survive off the land. That night, as they slept in their hammocks, Raleigh felt something brushing against him. He awoke in a panic, as if he were being attacked by a jaguar. But it was only one of the mules, which had broken free. After he tied it up, he tried to fall asleep again, but before long, dawn broke and Fawcett was shouting for everyone to move out, each person wolfing down a bowl of porridge and half a cup of condensed milk, his rations until supper. Then the men were off again, racing to keep up with their leader. Fawcett increased the pace from 7 miles a day to 10 miles, then to 15. One afternoon, as the explorers approached the Manso River, some 40 miles north of Cuyaba, the rest of the expedition became separated from Fawcett. As Jack later wrote to his mother, "Daddy had gone on ahead at such a speed that we lost sight of him altogether." It was just as Costin had feared. There was no one to stop Fawcett. The trail forked, and the Brazilian guides didn't know which way Fawcett had turned. Eventually, Jack noticed indentations from hooves on one of the trails and gave the order to follow them. Darkness was descending, and the men had to be careful not to lose each other as well. They could hear a sustained roar in the distance. With each step, it grew louder, and suddenly the men discerned the rush of water. They had reached the Manso River. Still, Fawcett was nowhere to be found. Jack, assuming command of the party, told Raleigh and one of the guides to fire their rifles in the air. There was no reply. "Daddy!" Jack yelled, but all he could hear was the screeching of the forest. Jack and Raleigh hung their hammocks and made a fire, fearing that Fawcett had been seized by the Kayapo Indians, who inserted large round discs in their lower lips and attacked their enemies with wooden clubs. The Brazilian guides, who recalled vivid accounts of Indian raids, did nothing to calm Jack's and Raleigh's nerves. The men lay awake, listening to the jungle. When the sun rose, Jack ordered everyone to fire more gunshots and to search the surrounding area. Then, as the explorers were eating breakfast, Fawcett appeared on his horse. While looking for rock paintings, he had lost track of the group and had slept on the ground using his saddle for a pillow. When Nina heard what had happened, she feared how anxious they all must have been. She had received a photograph of Jack looking unusually somber, which she had shown to Large. "Jack has evidently been thinking about the big job before him," Large told her. She noted later that Jack's pride would keep him going, for he would say to himself, "My father chose me for this." Fawcett let the expedition remain in camp another day to recover from the ordeal. Huddling under his mosquito net, he composed his dispatches, which from that point on would be relayed to civilization by Indian runners over a long and perilous route, as editor's notes later explained. Fawcett described the area as the tickiest place in the world. The insects swarmed over everything, like black rain. Several bit Raleigh on his foot, and the irritated flesh became infected, poisoned, in Jack's phrase. As they pressed on the next day, Raleigh grew more and more gloomy. "It is a saying that one only knows a man well when in the wilds with him," Fawcett told Nina. "Raleigh, in place of being gay and energetic, is sleepy and silent." Jack, in contrast, was gaining in ardor. Nina was right. He seemed to have inherited Fawcett's freakish constitution. Jack wrote that he had packed on several pounds of muscle in spite of far less food. "Raleigh has lost more than I gained, and it is he who seems to feel most the effects of the journey." Upon hearing about Jack from her husband, Nina told Large, "I think you will rejoice with me in the knowledge that Jack is turning out so capable and keeping strong and well. I can see his father is very pleased with him, and needless to say, so am I." Because of Raleigh's condition and the weakened animals, Fawcett, who was more careful not to get too far ahead again, stopped for several days at a cattle breeding ranch owned by Hermenegildo Galvao, one of the most ruthless farmers in Mato Grosso. Galvão had pushed farther into the frontier than most Brazilians, and reportedly had a posse of bugueros, savage hunters, who were charged with killing Indians who threatened his feudal empire. Galvão was not accustomed to visitors, but he welcomed the explorers into his large red-brick home. It was quite obvious from his manners that Colonel Fawcett was a gentleman and a man of engaging personality, Galvão later told a reporter. For several days, the explorers remained there, eating and resting. Galvão was curious about what had lured the Englishmen into such wilderness. As Fawcett described his vision of Z, he removed from his belongings a strange object covered in cloth. He carefully unwrapped it, revealing the stone idol Haggard had given to him. He carried it with him like a talisman. The three Englishmen were soon on their way again, heading east toward Bacari Post, where in 1920 the Brazilian government had set up a garrison, the last point of civilization, as the settlers referred to it. Occasionally, the forest opened up, and they could see the blinding sun and blue-tinged mountains in the distance. The trail became more difficult, and the men descended steep, mud-slicked gorges and traversed rock-strewn rapids. One river was too dangerous for the animals to swim across with the cargo. Fawcett noticed a canoe, abandoned, on the opposite bank, and said that the expedition could use it to transport the gear, but that someone would need to swim over and get it, a feat involving, as Fawcett put it, considerable danger, being made worse by a sudden violent thunderstorm. Jack volunteered and began to strip. Though he later admitted that he was scared stiff, he checked his body for cuts that might attract piranhas and dived in, thrashing his arms and legs as the currents tossed him about. When he emerged on the opposite bank, he climbed in the canoe and paddled back across, his father greeting him proudly. A month after the explorers left Cuiabá, and after what Fawcett described as a test of patience and endurance for the greater trials ahead, the men arrived at Bacari Post. The settlement consisted of about 20 ramshackle huts, cordoned off by barbed wire to protect against aggressive tribes. 3 years later, another explorer described the outpost as a pinprick on the map, isolated, desolate, primitive, and godforsaken. The Bacari tribe was one of the first in the region that the government had tried to acculturate, and Fawcett was appalled by what he called the Brazilian methods of civilizing the Indian tribes. In a letter to one of his sponsors in the United States, he noted, "The Bacairis have been dying out ever since they became civilized. There are only about 150 of them." He went on, "They have in part been brought here to plant rice, manioc, which is sent to Cuiabá, where it fetches at present high prices. The Bacairis are not paid, are raggedly clothed, mainly in khaki government uniforms, and there is a general squalor and lack of hygiene which is making the whole of them sick." Fawcett was informed that a Bacari girl had recently fallen ill. He often tried to treat the natives with his medical kit, but unlike Dr. Rice, his knowledge was limited and there was nothing he could do to save her. "They say the Bacairis are dying off on account of fetish, witchcraft, for there is a fetish man in the village who hates them," Jack wrote. "Only yesterday a little girl died. A fetish, they say." The Brazilian in charge of the post, Valdamira, put the explorers up in the newly constructed schoolhouse. The men soaked themselves in the river, washing away the grime and sweat. "We have all clipped our beards and feel better without them," Jack said. Members of other remote tribes occasionally visited Bacairi Post to obtain goods, and Jack and Raleigh soon saw something that astonished them. About 8 wild Indians, absolutely stark naked, as Jack wrote to his mother. The Indians carried 7-foot-long bows with 6-foot arrows. "To Jack's great delight, we have seen the first of the wild Indians here, naked savages from the Xingu," Fawcett wrote Nina. Jack and Raleigh hurried out to meet them. "We gave them some guava cheese," Jack wrote, "and they liked it immensely." Jack tried to conduct a rudimentary autopsy. "They are small people, about 5 feet 2 inches in height, and very well built. he wrote of the Indians. They eat only fish and vegetables, never meat. One woman had a very fine necklace of tiny discs cut from snail shells, which must have required tremendous patience to make. Raleigh, whom Fawcett had designated as the expedition's photographer, set up a camera and took pictures of the Indians. In one shot, Jack stood beside them to demonstrate the comparative sizes. The Indians came up to his shoulders. In the evening, the three explorers went to the mud hut where the Indians were staying. The only light inside was from a fire, and the air was filled with smoke. Fawcett unpacked a ukulele, and Jack took out a piccolo that they had brought from England. Fawcett told Nina that music was a great comfort in the wilds and might even save a solitary man from insanity. As the Indians gathered around them, Jack and Fawcett played a concert late into the night, the sounds wafting through the village. On May 19, a fresh, cool day, Jack woke up exhilarated. It was his 22nd birthday. "I have never felt so well," he wrote to his mother. For the occasion, Fawcett dropped his prohibition against liquor, and the three explorers celebrated with a bottle of Brazilian-made alcohol. The next morning, they prepared the equipment and the pack animals. To the north of the post, the men could see several imposing mountains and the jungle. It was, Jack wrote, absolutely unexplored country. The expedition headed straight for Terra Incognita. Before them were no clear paths, and little light filtered through the canopy. They struggled to see not just in front of them, but above them, where most predators lurked. The men's feet sank in mud holes. Their hands burned from wielding machetes. Their skin bled from mosquitoes. Even Fawcett confessed to Nina, "Years tell, in spite of the spirit of enthusiasm." Although Raleigh's foot had healed, his other one became infected, and when he removed his sock, a large patch of skin peeled off. He seemed to be unraveling. He had already suffered from jaundice, his arm was swollen, and he felt, as he put it, bilious. Like his father, Jack was prone to contempt for others' frailty, and complained to his mother that his friend was unable to share his burden of work. He rode on a horse with his shoe off, and that he was always scared and sullen. The jungle widened the fissures that had been evident since Raleigh's romance on the boat. Raleigh, overwhelmed by the insects, the heat, and the pain in his foot, lost interest in the quest. He no longer thought about returning as a hero. All he wanted, he muttered, was to open a small business and to settle down with a family. "The Fawcetts can have all my share of the notoriety and be welcome to it," he wrote his brother. When Jack talked of the archaeological importance of Z, Raleigh shrugged and said, "That's too deep for me." "I wish Raleigh had more brains, as I cannot discuss any of this with him, as he knows nothing of anything," Jack wrote. "We can only converse about Los Angeles or Seton. What he will do during a year at Z, I don't know." "I wish to hell you were here," Raleigh told his brother, adding, "You know there is a saying which I believe is true. Two's company, three's none. It shows itself quite often with me now." Jack and Fawcett, he said, maintained a sense of inferiority for others. "Consequently, at times I feel very out of everything. Of course, I do not outwardly show it, but still, as I have said before, I feel awful lonesome for real friendship." After 9 days, the explorers hacked their way to Dead Horse Camp, where the men could still see the white bones from Fawcett's old pack animal. The men were approaching the territory of the warlike Suyas and Kayapos. An Indian once described to a reporter a Kayapo ambush of his tribe. He and a few other villagers, the reporter wrote, fled across a river and witnessed throughout the night the macabre dance of their enemies around their slaughtered brothers. For 3 days, the invaders remained, playing wooden flutes and dancing among the corpses. After the Kayapos finally departed, the few villagers who had escaped across the river rushed back to their settlement. Not a single person was alive. The women, who they thought would have been spared, lay face up, their lifeless bodies in an advanced state of putrefaction, their legs spread apart by wooden struts forced between the knees. In a dispatch, Fawcett described the Kayapos as an aggressive lot of stick throwers who cut off and kill wandering individuals. Their only weapon is a short club like a policeman's billy, which, he added, they deploy very skillfully. After passing through the territory of the Suyas and the Kayapos, the expedition would turn eastward and confront the Chavante, who were perhaps even more formidable. In the late 18th century, many in the tribe had been contacted by the Portuguese and moved into villages, where they received mass baptisms. Devastated by epidemics and brutalized by Brazilian soldiers, they eventually fled back into the jungle near the River of Death. A 19th-century German traveler wrote that, from that time onwards, the Chavante no longer trusted any white man. These abused people have therefore changed from compatriots into the most dangerous and determined enemies. They generally kill anyone they can easily catch. Several years after Fawcett's journey, members of the Indian Protection Service tried to make contact with the Chavante, only to return to their base camp and discover the naked corpses of four of their colleagues. One was still clutching in his hand gifts for the Indians. In spite of the risks, Fawcett was confident. After all, he had always succeeded where others failed. "It is obviously dangerous to penetrate large hordes of Indians traditionally hostile," he wrote, "but I believe in my mission and in its purpose. The rest does not worry me, for I have seen a good deal of Indians and know what to do and what not to do." He added, "I believe our little party of three white men will make friends with them all." The guides, who were already feverish, were reluctant to go any farther, and Fawcett decided that the time had come to send them back. He selected half a dozen or so of the strongest animals to keep for a few more days. Then the explorers would have to proceed with their few provisions on their backs. Fawcett pulled Raleigh aside and encouraged him to return with the guides. As Fawcett had written to Nina, "I suspect constitutional weakness and fear that we shall be handicapped by him." After this point, Fawcett explained, there would be no way to carry him out. Raleigh insisted that he would see it through. Perhaps he remained loyal to Jack, in spite of everything. Perhaps he didn't want to be seen as a coward. Or perhaps he was simply afraid to turn back without them. Fawcett finished his last letters and dispatches. He wrote that he would try to get out other communiques in the coming year or so, but added that it was unlikely. As he noted in one of his final articles, "By the time this dispatch is printed, we shall have long since disappeared into the unknown." After folding up his missives, Fawcett gave them to the guides. Raleigh had earlier written to his dearest mother and family. "I shall look forward to seeing you again in Old Cal when I return," he said. And he told his brother bravely, "Keep cheerful and things will turn up all right, as they have for me." The explorers gave a final wave to the Brazilians, then turned and headed deeper into the jungle. In his last words to his wife, Fawcett wrote, "You need have no fear of any failure." Chapter 21. The Last Eyewitness. "Can you get the GPS to work?" Paolo asked. I was sitting in the back seat of a four-wheel drive Mitsubishi truck, fiddling with a global positioning system in an attempt to obtain readings of our coordinates. We were heading north, that much I knew, with a driver whom we had hired when we rented the pickup. Paolo had told me that we would need a powerful truck and a professional driver if we were to have any chance of completing our journey, especially in the rainy season. "This is the worst time of year," he said. "The roads are, how do you say in English, shit." When I explained my mission to our driver, he asked me when the British colonel had disappeared. 1925, I said. "And you want to find him in the jungle?" "Not exactly." "Are you one of his descendants?" "No." He seemed to think about this for a long moment, then said, "Very well," and began cheerfully to load our gear, which included hammocks, rope, mosquito netting, water purifying tablets, a satellite phone, antibiotics, and malarial pills. On our way out of Cuiabá, we also picked up a friend of Paolo's, a descendant of a Bacairi chief named Taucane Bacairi. In Brazil, the last names of Indians are typically the same as that of their tribe. Taucane, who was in his mid-40s and had a handsome, round face, wore Levi's and a baseball cap. He had been educated by missionaries, and though he now lived mostly in Cuiabá, he continued to represent his tribe's political interests. "I am what you might call an ambassador," he told me. And in exchange for a gift of 2 tires for a communal tractor, he had agreed to take us to his village, the last place that Fawcett had incontrovertibly been seen. "If it were up to me, I would take you for free," Taucane said. "But all Indians must now be capitalists. We have no choice." Upon leaving the city, we entered the central plains of Brazil, which marked the transition from dry forest to rainforest. After a while, a plateau came into view. Martian red in color, it spanned more than 2,000 square miles, an endless tabletop that reached into the clouds. We stopped at its base, and Paolo said, "Come, I show you something." We left the truck and climbed a steep, rocky slope. The ground was moist from a recent rainstorm, and we used our hands and knees to ascend, crawling over holes where snakes and armadillos had burrowed. "Where are we going?" I asked Paolo, who had another cigarette clamped between his teeth. "You Americans are always impatient," he said. Lightning streaked the sky, and a thin mist descended, making the ground more slippery. Rocks gave way under our feet, clapping as they hit the ground 50 yards below. "Almost there," Paolo said. He helped to pull me up a ledge, and as I got to my feet, covered in mud, he pointed at another ridge a few yards away and said, "Now you see." Jutting into the sky was a cracked stone column. I blinked in the rain. In fact, there was not just one, but several columns in a row, as in a Greek ruin. There was also a large archway, both sides of it intact, and behind it was a dazzlingly large tower. They looked like what the Bondeir Ranch had described in 1753. "What is it?" I asked. "Stone City." "Who built it?" "It is, how do you say, an illusion." "That?" I said, pointing to one of the columns. "It was made by nature, by erosion. But many people who see it think it is a lost city, like Z." In 1925, Dr. Rice had seen similarly eroded cliffs in Roraima, Brazil, and thought they looked like ruined architecture. As we returned to the car and headed north toward the jungle, Paolo said we would find out soon if Z were such a mirage. We eventually turned onto BR-163, one of the most treacherous roads in South America. Built in 1970 by the Brazilian government in an effort to open up the country's interior, it extends more than 1,000 miles from Cuiabá to the Amazon River. It was designated on our map as a major highway, but almost all the asphalt from its 2 lanes had been washed away during the rainy season, leaving behind a combination of ditches and puddle-filled gullies. Our driver sometimes chose to ignore the road altogether and steer along the rocky banks and fields, where herds of cattle occasionally parted in our midst. As we passed the Manso River, where Fawcett had gotten separated from the rest of the group, and where Raleigh had been bitten by ticks, I kept looking out the window, expecting to see the first signs of a fearsome jungle. Instead, the terrain looked like Nebraska, perpetual plains that faded into the horizon. When I asked Taucane where the forest was, he said simply, "Gone." A moment later, he pointed to a fleet of diesel-belching trucks heading in the opposite direction, carrying 60-foot logs. "Only the Indians respect the forest," Paolo said. "The white people cut it all down." Mato Grosso, he went on, was being transformed into domesticated farmland, much of it dedicated to soybeans. In Brazil alone, the Amazon has, over the last 4 decades, lost some 270,000 square miles of its original forest cover, an area bigger than France. Despite government efforts to reduce deforestation, in just 5 months in 2007, as much as 2,700 square miles were destroyed, a region larger than the state of Delaware. Countless animals and plants, many of them with potential medicinal purposes, have vanished. Because the Amazon generates half its own rainfall through moisture that rises into the atmosphere, the devastation has begun to change the region's ecology, contributing to droughts that destroy the jungle's ability to sustain itself. And few places have been as ravaged as Mato Grosso, where the state governor, Blair Omaggi, is one of the largest soybean producers in the world. "I don't feel the slightest guilt over what we are doing here," Maggi told the New York Times in 2003. "We're talking about an area larger than Europe that has barely been touched, so there is nothing at all to get worried about." The latest economic boom, meanwhile, has produced another of the Amazon's convulsions of violence. The Brazilian Transport Ministry has said that loggers along BR-163 employ the highest concentration of slave labor in the world. Indians are frequently driven off their land, enslaved or murdered. On February 12, 2005, while Paulo and I were making our journey into the jungle, several gunmen, allegedly on the payroll of a rancher in the state of Pará, approached a 73-year-old American nun who defended the rights of Indians. As the men aimed their guns, she removed her Bible and began to read from the Gospel of St. Matthew. "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice, for they shall be satisfied." The gunman unloaded 6 bullets into her, leaving her body face down in the mud. James Peterson, the distinguished scientist from the University of Vermont, who had trained the archaeologist Michael Heckenberger and had been extremely helpful in planning my trip, told me when we had last spoken, a few months earlier, that he was excited because he was heading into the Amazon to conduct research near Manaus. "Maybe you can visit me after the Xingu," he said. "That would be wonderful," I responded. But I soon discovered that in August, while he was with the Brazilian archaeologist Eduardo Neves at a restaurant in a village along the Amazon River, a pair of bandits, allegedly working for a former police officer, stormed in to rob the place. One of the thieves opened fire, hitting Peterson in the stomach. He fell to the ground and said, "I can't breathe." Neves told him he would be okay, but by the time they arrived at a hospital, Peterson had died. He was 51 years old. From BR-163, we veered onto a smaller dirt road, which went east, toward Bacairi Post. We passed close to where Fawcett had stayed with the cattle rancher, Galvao, and we decided to see if we could find his manor. In letters, Fawcett had said that the ranch was known as Rio Novo, and that name was marked on several current maps. After nearly 4 hours of bone-jarring bumps, we came upon a rusty sign at a fork in the road, Rio Novo, with an arrow pointing left. "Look at that," Paulo said. We crossed a wobbly, wooden, slatted bridge over a river. The bridge creaked under the weight of the truck, and we looked down at the torrent of water 50 feet below. "How many mules and horses did the coronel have?" Paulo asked, trying to picture Fawcett's crossing. "A dozen or so," I said. According to his letters, Galvao replaced some of the weakest animals and gave him a dog, which supposedly returned to the farm several months after Fawcett vanished. "It wandered back on its own?" Paulo asked. "That's what Galvao said. He also said something about some swallows he saw rise from the forest in the east, which he thought had to be some kind of sign from Fawcett." For the first time, we entered a swath of dense forest. Though there was no farm in sight, we came across a mud hut with a thatched roof. Inside was an old Indian sitting on a tree stump with a wooden cane in his hand. He was barefoot and wore dusty slacks without a shirt. Behind him, hanging on the wall, was the skin of a jaguar and a picture of the Virgin Mary. Taukane asked him, in the Bacairi language, if there was a cattle breeding ranch known as Rio Novo. The man spit when he heard the name and waved his cane toward the door. "That way," he said. Another Indian, who was younger, appeared and said that he would show us the way. We got back in the car and drove down an overgrown path, the branches clapping against the windshield. When we couldn't drive any farther, our guide hopped out, and we followed him through the forest as he slashed at the creepers and vines with a machete. Several times he paused, studied the tops of the trees, and took a few paces east or west. Finally, he stopped. We looked around. There was nothing but a cocoon of trees. "Where's Rio Novo?" Paolo asked. Our guide lifted his machete over his head and slammed it into the ground. It hit something hard.